No, I think we're done now. I think the weather moment has passed. So you're doing...
I mean, we can rant about weather. I don't mind.
No, it's okay.
Well, I'm always down for good... I'm always down for old men shouting about clouds.
Well, see, what happens is it rains in Boston and then we lose internet. And this has happened. I've been working here for almost 4 years now, and it has happened almost every time there's a significant storm. The internet is spotty. And the reason is we get our internet. Well, maybe not the reason, but we happen to get our internet in Boston via lasers from a company called TowerStream. So they have like a laser that goes to like the top of the Prudential Tower or Hancock Tower or something like that and carries us and brings us very fast internet in that way, which seems magical to me, but that's how it works. And every time the internet goes out in the rain, I say, oh, the internet's out because it's raining. And then somebody in the office who shall remain nameless says, that's not how lasers work. And this person's not incorrect, yet neither am I, because every time it rains... we lose internet. So the actual working theory is that when it rains, it gets windy and maybe like the thing that secures the laser gets like blown around a little more and goes out of spec for where it needs to be or whatever. So hopefully we don't lose internet. Hopefully it's not too windy or rainy. Hopefully the lasers continue to work. Now, you were saying you're building rack with Rust.
Just that's the level of abstraction that we are focusing on right now.
So building a thing that allows you to write web apps in Rust, does the communication with the server, that kind of thing?
Yeah, the middleware stack, basically. Right. So basically, I don't know if you saw all of the stuff that's been happening around futures and async IO.
Nope.
So a little while back, by a little while, I mean like this was a few weeks ago, I think, at most, they announced a new futures library for Rust. That's interesting. So, because there's many, many different approaches you can take to providing abstractions for asynchronous computation. Futures is one of them. Futures are similar, basically the same thing as promises in JavaScript, but it's basically it wraps a value and says this may or may not be there at some point in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And then the collection equivalent is called stream, usually. So there were two libraries that have come out for Rust. The first is called Futures RS, which just provides the base level interfaces. Now, what's interesting about Rust's futures. So in async IO, there are sort of two models that people talk about. There's the readiness model and the completion model. And so the readiness model is where you get informed, hey, like this socket is ready to be read from. You can now read from it without blocking. Whereas the completion model is you say that you want to read from the socket and then you get notified when the read is complete.
Okay.
And futures usually get modeled in what is analogous to the completion form, where you give it what is effectively a callback.
Yep.
And that callback gets run when it's there. And what ends up happening with Rust's futures is it's actually closer to the readiness model. So instead of the, you still have all of the combinators that you'd want. So the main ones being map and then. Map taking just a normal synchronous function and doing it on an asynchronous value, and then taking a value and returning an asynchronous computation on it. But we don't have like the equivalent of what would be like await or for each or like when this is ready do stuff. Instead, there's the lowest level method is called poll. And what poll will do is either give you the value if it's ready or tell you that it's not ready and somehow arrange for itself to be notified when it is ready. But like it doesn't provide the actual event loop that's responsible for all of this. The futures library doesn't actually provide it, doesn't provide that. And there's no assumption that like this is going to be an abstraction on top of threads or any other form of asynchrony. Whatever the word is, and the intention is that gets provided by a higher level library. So like the futures library itself isn't necessarily like it's something that you're intended to be aware of, that you're intended to use the APIs provided by in terms of like combining futures and doing stuff to futures, but you're not necessarily intended to use it directly, because at least to get the values out of it, the intention is like how you actually then go about getting the values out of it is in the domain of Like, that's something web servers care about, but it's not something that you as an application author care about. You care about just returning futures, and then we figure out how to actually schedule those and run them. Now, the reason they did all of that is that it lets it be a completely zero-cost abstraction. And there were some benchmarks shown on a very naive web server. Not the sort of thing that you would want to actually build applications in, but doing the minimum amount of work that a web server needs to do for a Hello World benchmark, which is basically parse HTTP and include the relevant information. And in the Hello World test, which is a benchmark that I completely hate, because it doesn't give much useful information, but the intention, if you buy into it, the intention is that it's supposed to show the amount of overhead that a web framework or a web server has. And in these benchmarks, the results built on futures, both in the synchronous and pipelined benchmarks, blew everything else out of the water, including the fastest. The next two fastest competitors are written in Go and Java. Now, well, I don't necessarily think that's a great benchmark for measuring the performance of web servers, because there's just too much stuff going on there that has inherent overhead that, like, a Hello World benchmark encourages skipping or making lazy in ways that would have actual performance hits in real world usage. However, for something like a futures library, that is an abstraction where it makes a lot of sense to measure the inherent overhead. And so the answer in this case is none. So it does everything without dynamic dispatch and without allocate. Well, there is, according to the authors, exactly one allocation and one dynamic dispatch in a place that costs. So it becomes effectively zero cost.
Right. Awesome.
Yeah. Anyway, so with that, and then the level on top of that is called Tokyo, which is sort of the one-stop shop for async IO and Rust built on top of futures. So now that that's there, the next sort of step that we're taking is Rack and Rust. So figuring out a middleware layer, basically, and a common protocol for servers to adhere to.
How do you decide what goes into that? Like, what are the appropriate middleware-y type things that this library is going to take care of?
Well, so the library, like, there's going to be probably a bunch of different libraries that are part of this current initiative that is happening. Like, the base library won't provide any middlewares. It'll just be the, like, hey, here's the infrastructure for having middlewares.
Okay.
But one of the things, like, this is all very fresh, and I'm still in the, like, experimenting with APIs and validating ideas, but we had a chat yesterday, some of the other people who are working on this. And one of the things that we sort of are agreeing on is that, looking at, like, middlewares in Ruby, people try to shoehorn too many things into middleware.
Hmm.
So we need an additional abstraction level that, like, does a better job of doing what people are trying to use middlewares for. Like, middleware, in my mind, is something that the level of abstraction it operates on is HTTP.
Okay.
So it, like, does transformations on requests and responses. So some really good examples of, like, sort of your traditional middleware would be content negotiation, gzipping. We have a middleware to do head requests in Rails or in Rack. So stuff like that.
Forcing SSL?
Yeah, that could be a middleware. Yeah, definitely.
What about things like, so, like, I'm trying to think of, like, middleware that I've written and added to apps and been like, yeah, this seems like a good place to do this. So, like, when you're writing a JSON API and you're processing requests, and in my app, I don't want to deal with, like, whatever format we have for timestamps, right? So we have an epoch, however you say that. Or you have maybe just a string that you have to parse or something like that.
Right.
And so, like, I've written middleware that looks for, like, all fields that end with underscore at and parses, right? And then you get, like, the actual objects you want to use in your application at that point. That's
right.
Not HTTP. That's just, like,
right.
Application level logic, and I stuck it in Rack because I know it happens with every request, and that's what I want to have happen with every request.
Right. So there is one interesting assumption you're making there, and this gets at sort of why we want to break some of this apart. So your assumption there is also that parameters have been parsed, right? And that the result is a hash map.
Yes.
And that's just a thing that is there to be accessed.
Yes.
So there's a couple of things there. Like, whether... So whether or not you want to be able to just directly access something as a hash map, A, can vary on the request type, or on the content type of the request. Like, so a lot of middleware, both on both ends of the stack, when I say both ends, I mean on dealing with requests and dealing with responses. Too many middleware in the Ruby world specifically like want the body to be there.
Okay.
There's a lot of interesting work you can do. You can get pretty far in the processing cycle without having to touch the body, as long as everything is structured in a way that's like, hey, I'm going to like put all of the work that only requires the headers first.
Mm-hmm.
Now, with requests, I think it's probably okay to have, like, as you get closer to the application, have middleware there, like, and now I need the body. Because one of the kind of canonical examples of a thing that probably lives best in a middleware, but maybe not, I'm not sure, is CSRF protection.
Okay, yep.
And so you need a couple of things. So first of all, you need the session.
Mm-hmm.
And again, and this is another one of these things where I'm like, you need the session. And I say that, and we as Rails developers are like, oh yeah, and you just get the session. Like that, like,
right.
And we think of that as like, that's just a thing that's there, right. But there's actually a lot of
other things, right? Like cookies, right. And whatnot.
Well, yeah, well, and right, or, but that's the thing. Yeah. And that's a trade-off, because if you're storing the session entirely in the cookie, then you have a strict 2 kilobyte limit on the amount of data that can be stored in the session.
Right.
Right. And so, but yeah, so that's it. So you may just need the cookie and then decoding stuff, or you may need a database connection in order to do that, which to establish that database connection, you might have needed to make additional decisions already. But anyway, so you'll need the session. And then the other thing you'll need is, depending on the type of request, you may or may not need access to the parsed request body. Specifically in the case of web forms, you would want the parsed request body.
Right. You want to verify that the token that got submitted there is the appropriate token.
Right. Now, there's an argument for, like, just put it in the URL.
Yeah.
Which is, like, actually probably fine. Either, like, because if you're not doing a web form, you'd put it in a header.
Right.
And there's just no reason not to do it that way if you're doing anything other than a web form. For a web form, it's like, yeah, just put it in the URL. It's fine.
I'm trying to think through things. Yeah, I mean, I guess that's fine. My only reaction to that was, like, I've been places that, like, just stick CSRF things on all URLs, like, as a matter of course. Like, here's a token, and it's on the end of every link, on the end of every form post, on the end of everything. As long as you're doing it only on posts, that's fine.
Right.
Anything a user might copy and paste somewhere, you do not want to include a token on the URL.
Correct. Yes. No, definitely. Anything that's a GET request should never have CSRF, because CSRF makes no sense in the context of a GET request.
Right. All you're doing is leaking. All you're doing is either improperly using HTTP and mutating state on GET requests, or leaking, or potentially leaking the tokens by people copying and pasting links to other places.
Right.
Which I've seen before. So anyway,
but either way,
neither here nor there.
The thing that I'm wanting to do is sort of separate out the idea of the terminology that we landed on that may or may not actually survive were transformers and providers. Transformers being the more traditional middlewares, and then providers being the things that tend to get shoehorned into middleware but don't necessarily actually fit there. And I think one of the best examples of a thing that is currently represented as a middleware in Rails but absolutely should be in this other structure is checking out a database connection from a connection pool.
Yeah, that makes sense.
Now, Rust has some secret sauce here. So what I'm kind of imagining for providers, and this, I realized after some conversations that maybe making this comparison isn't the best idea because it draws too many parallels that I think this is a fundamentally different thing. But like, basically, I'm imagining a form of like Java-style DI.
Okay.
So you register your functions, which will take a request. And the idea is that this provider caches per request. So your function takes a request and returns a thing that can be dereferenced into the value that you want. Now, the thing that makes the sort of secret sauce that Rust provides that like makes this ergonomic and makes it possible to use this in places that required a middleware before is that we have drop. So we have the ability to deterministically run some code when a value is no longer needed. So we don't need a lexical scope to check out a value from a connection pool and then check it back in at the end. We are able to check out a value from the connection pool and automatically have it go back in when it's no longer being used. So it no longer needs to be in a middleware. So it can just be, hey, give me a thing, a connection from the connection pool, and you don't have to remember to return it to the pool when you're done with it. And because of that nature of Rust, like, we can fit a lot more things into this provider style than you could in other languages. And one of the big benefits of that is that, because one of the pain points, I think, with middleware is that order matters, like, a lot.
Right.
And it's easy to get wrong. And the method that we have for communicating between a middleware and another middleware, or a middleware and an application, is sticking magic keys into this hash.
Yep.
Which feels super wrong. And order, like, this doesn't make order matter less, but this does make order automatic. Because any provider that relies on other providers has to request the other providers. So if getting the session relies on a database connection, you don't have to make sure that the session parser middleware comes after the establishes database connection middleware.
Right. Yeah, we've had these problems in clearance before where, like, things change in Rails, and then, like, where we're inserting our middleware, which gets you the current user, where we're inserting that middleware is no longer valid. And then it's like, well, why were we inserting it in this place in the first place? And you're like, I don't know. Like, let's just put it at the end and see if that works. It works. Okay. We'll keep it at the end. That sounds fine.
And I think that's another, like, that's actually a good example of a thing that is, like, a super specific app level concern, but I do think can fit into this provider mechanism, right? Getting the current user.
Yeah.
But then, and then you'll still have your sort of pure HTTP layer middleware, and order will still be very important for them. But I think it becomes better at that point, just because, A, like, I think when you're dealing with, like, so I'm going to use this as an example because it's very self-contained, but just a middleware that computes a content length header is an absolutely abysmally bad idea, and nobody should ever do it ever. But because it makes a really simple example, let's say you have a middleware that gzips your body, and a middleware that adds a content length header. It's very important that the content length header middleware comes before the gzipping, or above the gzipping, the body middleware, so that way you calculate the length on the gzipped body and not the uncompressed body. But I think it's a lot easier to reason about with those types of middleware, the order that they need to go in. And it's also just, if we shrink the stack, if we move as much as possible out of that stack, the places where order is really important, it's so much easier to get right, because, like, you only have to worry about 10 middleware, not 50.
Right, yeah. And there are times when you, like, do, what's the rake task?
Rake middleware,
where you run that, and I wonder, like, how much of this is there because, like, that's just where it got inserted, and how much of this is there because it needs to be there? And there's, like, there's an example of, like, what's the example I'm thinking of? Like, it's a gzip middleware plus etag middleware, and if you get that order wrong, then you end up etagging the wrong... You end up etagging the uncompressed thing, but you're sending the compressed thing. Like, that kind of stuff gets kind of crazy. And the order does matter there, but it's hard to see in the sea of, you know, I don't know what the default middleware... I think the default middleware stack shrunk in Rails 5, if I'm correct. But anyway, it's a lot.
Yeah. Well, and you end up with, like, there is... So this is one of the other things that we were talking about as a pain point when it comes to ordering of middleware was, so one of the big pain points, right, is when you do need something to happen at a specific point in the stack, what people will do is they'll say, like, insert before this other middleware from the default stack, because that's where my middleware needs to be.
Yeah, that's what happened in clearance. Yep.
But then that other middleware moves.
Yep, exactly.
And now your middleware is in the wrong place.
Yep.
Which actually probably just means that you were saying insert before this thing, but you actually meant to insert before this other thing. Or really, I guess you probably wanted to say, I need to run before all of these things.
Maybe.
Or after all of these things. Anyway, our solution is going to be, you can either put something at the very beginning of the stack, you can put something at the very end of the stack. There will be no insert before, insert after, and if you need something more granular than that, then what you do is you take the default stack and you explicitly put that in your code so that we can't break you.
Yeah, that's a good solution.
Which means that at that point, we no longer, like, we lose control to the ability to change that automatically later, but you're now doing something that would potentially break, so.
Right. But hopefully the idea is for that type of stuff, you'd be using these provider things, like things that have dependencies like that, hopefully, maybe.
Right. I mean, just most things would go there, I think.
Right.
Unless it's a very HTTP-specific thing.
Yeah,
there's going to definitely be gray areas. Session in particular is one that I'm not sure what I want to do with that, because, like, if sessions were read only, which would make them completely useless, but pretend for a minute that sessions magically were there and you just needed to read the session, a read only session fits very nicely into that provider model. The fact that you can write to it, and depending on how you're storing the session, like, that's going to modify potentially the database, potentially the request, and potentially both. and when and how that happens is important. I'm not entirely sure. Like, that one's a very fuzzy, like, where should this live? If you're just talking about a pure cookie session, that fits actually much more nicely into your traditional middleware form, although I'm not sure how you communicate then, like, and here's the session that you can modify down to the application, because I don't want to provide just the magic hash map. So that one's going to be, that one's sort of murky. And there's definitely always going to be sort of the gray areas. And again, this is super, super early in like the design lifecycle, so I'm still figuring a lot of things out on it. But I do feel pretty confident in the general direction for some of the things that are more clearly on one side or the other, like gzipping the response body or checking out a database connection from a connection pool.
Yeah. Sounds like an interesting thing to explore anyway and see how that fares when it hits the real world.
Yeah. And it's all going to be around async.io, so streaming everything sort of by default.
Cool.
Yeah, it'll be good.
What else
is
going on?
So Vim 8 came out.
Oh, yeah, Vim 8. Yes.
So all of your reasons for using NeoVim are now completely invalid.
Pretty close, yeah. And I didn't, like, when I published that article, so we'll link to it in the show notes, but I published an article that was basically like, I've switched to NeoVim. I've been using it for 8 months. I haven't really noticed that I'm using NeoVim except for the fact that this one particular use case I have is now much faster. And the particular use case I had was I was using Syntastic with Vim, and I feel like that runs fast enough on Ruby files that it's not a problem. But once I got to a compiled language, it would lock up my editor every time I wrote the file, because I'm trying to have it give me warnings in my editor, and it wasn't doing that asynchronously because Vim had no support for that, really.
Which language was this for?
Elixir.
Elixir's compiler is slow enough that it was noticeable?
Yeah, and I think various things impact compile time, like how many things do you have aliased. When there are aliases, it has to like compile more things because it doesn't know how exactly you're using them. It gets faster with every release, but it's definitely noticeable.
Scala was the language. I had the same pain, but specifically Scala, because Scala C was just slow.
Right. And there's lots of other things too, like somehow I must have some sort of markdown processor linter installed, because every time I tried to write, like, you automatically get opted into these linters if you have the right linter installed somewhere. It's probably an NPM package I had to install for some reason. And like every time I would go to write a markdown file, it would just like hang, like, oh, it's doing that stupid thing. How do I disable this again? And then finally I just switched over to NeoVim and it's not a problem. Well, I had to switch to NeoVim and NeoMake because Syntastic doesn't support the way that NeoVim does its asynchronous jobs. But anyway, as soon as I published that article, people were like, well,
she really wants to be on the podcast.
Hello, kitty.
Get off. She will not stop jumping on me.
as soon as I published that article, people were like, well, what about Vim 8? And I was like, I didn't know that was a thing, and it's not out yet. And then like 2 weeks later, it was like, it's out.
Yep.
And it has an asynchronous job type thing where it can communicate between with a background process with JSON, I think. But Syntastic, as far as when I checked the other day, had not been updated to use it. But a couple of issues where people were like, I want async support, were responded to with basically like, when Vim has the async job stuff, we'll update. So at some point, maybe I'll switch back to Vim 8 just to be on Vim proper, I guess.
Well, and right. So Vim more or less has feature parity with NeoVim now, but the reasons for NeoVim are much more than just like we want to add features. A lot of it had to do with the management and longevity of the project.
Correct. And I think that they've made their point. I'm not saying that they're done, but I think message was received based on what we're seeing in Vim 8, which also included a decent amount of code cleanup and included some stuff for testing plugins.
Did it include patches from other contributors?
Yes, it did. Yep. There's a lot of patches from other contributors in there. And it's I don't think it's ever been that other contributors couldn't contribute to Vim. It's that when there were big things that people wanted to do, like the asynchronous job stuff, there were at least two patches that were submitted to Vim to do asynchronous patches. And they weren't up to Bram's, he's the maintainer of Vim, up to whatever he had in mind for doing this feature.
All right.
And instead of like saying what it was he had in mind or like providing feedback on the thing, it was just like, we'll link to the threads in the show notes. I don't want to mischaracterize it, but I think the impression was basically like, this isn't the way I want to do it. And then the impression the people who submitted the thing got was that like he was going to go off and do it his own way, which is totally fine, but except that like...
But he never did. Well,
he eventually did, and we don't know what's going on and like why these solutions aren't the right thing. And then people were getting frustrated about... I don't know, like one of the things they did was like NeoVim did was like eliminate support for a bunch of like really old operating systems that it probably doesn't need to support.
Right.
They allow you to write plugins in what are they?
Anything.
Is it anything? But there's like a specific...
Well, because plugins communicate over JSON RPC now, right?
Yes.
And so because they're separate from the actual editor, yeah, they can be any language they want.
Structured communication to and from any programming language. Remote plugins run as co-processes that communicate with NeoVim safely and asynchronously. So, yeah.
Yep.
And the other thing that people often cite about NeoVim, and I mentioned in the article I wrote, was the terminal. So it has a terminal emulator.
Yes.
In it.
Well, and Vim 8 does not have a terminal emulator, correct?
No, it does not. And in the article, I was like, I kind of loosely tried to use this terminal emulator, and it never stuck. I went back to Tmux. And so after I wrote that article, I spent a week living without Tmux with the terminal emulator in Vim, and they were like, getting it configured so it was sane took me about a day. But even then, like, it's just I was talking to Chris Toomey, who's a big Vim user in our Boston office, and he was like, yeah, it's just uncanny valley. Like, it's like a terminal enough that you expect it to behave the way you want it to, but then it's not quite a terminal. And why don't you just use Tmux and get an actual terminal? So I went back.
I've never been a big Tmux fan personally. I don't use Tmux.
What do you use when you need a terminal?
Terminal? Colon bang.
Colon bang.
I use colon bang for one-off things, and if I need to do like super terminal things, I just do control Z to background Vim, do my terminal things, and then FG to go back to Vim.
What about running your tests?
Colon bang, run my tests.
So like if the tests take a long time, you just sit there staring at the output from your tests?
No, I make, well, A, make it so the tests don't take a long time. and B, I guess I will occasionally use, if I do have a long running process, I'll use a tab from iTerm.
Yeah. I mean, I use dispatch, and that's probably the chief, like I just don't want to lose that context of what I'm looking at in the editor. So I'll just like, the two things I will do is run my test with dispatch, which will open a terminal, run the tests. And if everything passes, just immediately closes it. And I'm like, great, it passed. I don't need to deal with anything. And if it fails, it takes the output from the shell and puts it in the split, in a split down the bottom from Vim, which I find pretty nice. And then the other thing I use it for is Git. I could never get into the using fugitive for everything.
I just use fugitive or colon bang.
Yeah, so I couldn't quite get into that. I've been trying out Git shell, which is a thing that George Brockerhurst, my former coworker in New York. So I've been trying that out. So I have like a keyboard shortcut that I can hit in Tmux that just automatically opens me the Git shell split, and then I can close that and goes away, does what I need. So I'm still back in Tmux. I don't think the terminal. I don't know. I'm not. I also experimented with Emacs during all of this because I was like, oh, they have like all these fun things that they can do with their editor.
Yeah,
but I just,
well, because it's an operating system.
I just can't figure it out. Like, I did use Emacs when I was in college, but I've forgotten everything except like the most basic keyboard shortcuts that are, you know, basically everywhere in OS X and things like that. You know, Control A, Control E, like all those basic things I can do. But like when it comes to operating, like I opened up I installed like just basic Emacs through Homebrew with OS X support, so it had like a GUI version of Emacs. And I opened that up and it was like, press this key shortcut to go to the tutorial. And I couldn't even get, I was like, I'm pressing that keyboard combination. Go to the tutorial. And it just wouldn't go to the tutorial.
Wasn't that one of the jokes of what Emacs stands for? Escape, Control, Alt, Meta, Shift.
It wasn't supposed to, it was like Control L or Control H or something like that. And I was like, I'm doing that. Anyway.
No, so here's my super terrible reason as to why I don't use Tmux, even though I know I'd probably be slightly more efficient if I did. What's your Tmux leader key?
Control S. Boom! Okay.
Oh, that's different. Most people say Control A.
Yeah, but then how do you go to the beginning of the line?
Well, that's not even what it is for me.
No,
so, because
okay.
That one, my answer for that one is Control F0. But no, so... Control A, a lesser known usage is if you have a percent or percent colon H or any of the like Vims expand to some function of the current file and or position of the cursor,
mm-hmm,
in command mode, Control A will expand that.
Okay.
And when I'm doing things that I have a little script that's actually is broken now in more cases than not, and it's a horrendous shell script, but it's basically like, try to figure out what language this is and try to figure out how to run the tests. And then if it's a language where I cared enough to hyper-optimize for this, make us terrible assumptions to make the tests run slightly faster. So, like, if it was a file that I'm pretty sure is going to be run with RSpec, skip bundle exec and just assume that I have the latest version of RSpec installed and the project is on the latest version of RSpec.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, and when I'm doing something that my little script doesn't work for, it'll be, you know, like, Ruby hyphen I test that file, but I'm still going to want to switch to another pane and be able to do control up enter and run the test really fast. So I do control A to expand that, and that doesn't work.
Right.
If I use the leader that everybody wants, and then I'm like, okay, fine, I just won't use that. What key combination am I not using that is convenient to get to?
Control S.
No, control S does a thing. Control S.
It, like, freezes the terminal or something like that, I think?
No, I have it bound with... I remember specifically looking at Control-S. What do I have Control-S bound to?
The ThoughtBot setup actually has... I think it has two leader keys. You can use either Control-S or you can use the default of Control-B. Because using defaults when you don't have a reason not to is a pretty good idea.
Oh, so. Apparently Control-S is unbound. I thought Control-S did something. Okay, maybe I'll try Tmux and just do S.
There you go.
Well, now you've ruined my curmudgeonly argument. There's also my argument of, like, I have very... So I use the mouse to scroll long terminal output, and I know how to do leader back...
You can enable, like, mouse modes.
Yeah, I know. I just have muscle memory, and I have to learn things. This is also why I don't use Pry, even though I know I should be using Pry, but I just do puts everywhere. So you know, the nice thing about frontline debugging, I never hate a language because of its lack of debugger support.
Because you can always print something.
Frontline debugging works everywhere.
It's true.
Works better in some languages than others. Frontline debugging actually kind of sucks in Java.
Right. And they don't have
like a dot inspect method.
And your IDE that you're using has a pretty good debugger. So.
Yeah, I never use those. I don't know. It's just one of those, like, I know I'd be better off using Pry. There's no good reason for me not to use Pry other than just muscle memory. And it's just like, when I have an issue, by the time I did do it the other day when I had been spending 15 minutes trying to print line debug something. I'm like, why don't I just put some Pry in here? But usually by the time I think to use Pry, I've already solved the problem with print line debugging.
All right, then. I just use Pry for basically everything.
Seems fine.
Like today I was dealing with, like, I knew I needed to do some time zone conversions of stuff, and I was like, I had the test I wanted and I started writing the implementation. I was like, I have no idea what goes in this implementation. I could look up the API docs, or I could just put binding.pry here and just let the test run and screw around with it in the console in the context that I've already set up from my test case. Like, there was a bunch of setup I had to do, so now all that setup is done, boom, right in there. No puts debugging.
The one thing that always gets me, though, when I'm pairing with somebody who uses Pry, is we'll be debugging something and they'll put a Pry somewhere and we'll have established, like, okay, we figured out what we needed Pry there for, or, like, maybe we didn't, but, like, we're no longer prying there, we're going on to do a different thing, but they'll leave the Pry line there.
Yeah.
And then we'll run the test and they'll be like, oh, control D, control D, control D 3 or 4 times every time it hits that Pry line.
Yeah.
And then do the thing, and then we'll run the test again. Okay, control D, control. I'm like, delete the Pry line, we're not using it anymore. Oh my god.
Exit. So in those situations, I use exit-program, which will, like, kill the thing that's calling Pry in the first place. So it'll kill your entire test suite, and then I go in and I delete the thing.
Yeah, which is the same thing to do, because
right.
You don't need it there.
I've also been known to check in binding.pry before, which is fun.
Yeah.
Travis likes that particularly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so, like, are you using Vim 8?
No, because I forgot to check if it was in homebrew yet.
There was a patch yesterday. I don't know if it's actually... I imagine it's merged by now, but
I'm
not sure.
I'll probably end up running brew update in a few days, and I will get it that way.
Yeah.
Like, there's nothing in there that's like, oh my god, I'm dying for this, because I don't do Scala anymore, and Rust-C runs really fast for just the checking that Syntastic does, so...
I bet it would be even faster.
Probably. Well, it'd be even more asynchronous.
Yes.
it very specifically, it would not be faster.
It would be slower, probably.
It'd be slightly, yeah, it'd be a very slightly slower, but...
but you would notice that you are not hung up for that small millisecond when you try and change lines or something.
Yes. There was... So, actually, just random tangent before we wrap up. on editors and asynchronous stuff. So there's an editor written in Rust called Xi, Z something. It's spelled XI. It's a 20% project by somebody at Google. He gave a talk on it at RustConf. Oh, by the way, RustConf was amazing. I've never been as excited about the language as I am after RustConf. Anyway, he gave a talk about it, and one of the things he was talking about was, like, everything is asynchronous. And so it sort of got a similar model to how NeoVim wants the communication between, like, where the editor itself is basically a server, and there are multiple front ends communicating via JSON RPC, like, message passing event type things.
Mm-hmm.
And he was he got into a little bit, like, some of the, okay, so what happens if you're waiting on, I don't remember what, I think it might have been syntax checking, it might have been something more like re-indenting the file, something that would somehow edit the file, but then while you're waiting for that to complete, because it's asynchronous, you do more edits, and how you, like, get all of the resynchronization to happen. It was vaguely interesting, but one of the things I've been pushing for a lot in Rust is higher kind of types, and one of the big concerns about adding higher kind of types to Rust, other than just it's complex and we don't necessarily know all of the effects it will have, it's also that, like, we don't want to turn into Haskell. And I've always dismissed that argument until this talk about an editor written in Rust went on a 3-slide tangent about monoid homomorphisms.
Okay.
I'm like, all right, you have single-handedly convinced me our community is not yet ready for higher kind of types.
Sure.
If you can't not use the word homoid monomorphism,
higher kind of types is enough.
Well, no, you don't get higher kind of types, which lets you actually have proper monoid homomorphisms in a language.
Sure. I don't know what you just said.
But, like, that's my point, right?
Right.
Use words that normal people can understand.
That's like the, if you go into the Elm thing and you say monad, they say, it gets, like, the Slackbot replies and says, I think you mean, I don't know, whatever they
signal.
Call it, signal or whatever they call it. Like, they just refuse to embrace the, like, functional, is that functional programming terminology or Haskell terminology or ML terminology?
It's mathematics terminology.
Yeah, so they refuse to embrace that and just say, like, no, we're going to speak the language of, like, whatever.
Oh, but they
is.
Have functor.
Do they have, in Elm, do they call it functor?
Yeah, they have functor. Oh, okay. Yeah, they have functor. And they maybe they don't have functor. I think that Elm might actually just have things that have a method called map. Because what Rust does as well, we have ad hoc monads and ad hoc functors where we have things that we have them, you just can't abstract over the concept of a functor or a monad. And it's a useful thing to be able to do, but, like, so it's one of those, when I look at Haskell, it's like, okay, so you called it traversable and not mappable and flat mappable.
Okay.
Right, like, where's the super hand wavy term that nobody will ever understand for traversable? Why does that get to have a name that just says what it is?
I don't know. Kind of.
I mean, traversing is still a very abstract concept. But you know what I mean? Why not just call functor mappable?
That's the conversation we had when we were reading that Haskell book, the Learn You a Haskell. And I was like, oh, it just means you can... Why don't they just call it mappable? And it's, you know, academics. That's why.
Yeah, that's a terrible reason.
Well, I mean, it is not a terrible reason if you are an academic.
Right. I'm not an academic.
Yeah. Right.
I don't know. Anyway, that just the talking about async editor stuff made me think of that talk. So random tangent rant. I'm done now.
Okay.
You want to wrap up?
Yes. Let's do that. Show notes for this episode can be found at bikeshed.fm/80.
As always, ratings and reviews on iTunes or Google Play are much appreciated.
If you have feedback about this episode or any of our other episodes, you can tweet us @_bikeshed, email us at host@bikeshed.fm, or leave a comment on the website.
Thanks for listening to Bike Shed, and we'll see you next time.
Pring!